Hey, y'all, it's Melissa Harris-Perry with you here on The Takeaway, and it's good to have you along with us. Take a listen to something with me.
It's admitted in the Times, New York Times reports, or Time Magazine, that a recent survey shows that racism is broader and stronger than before. We're not gaining ground, my friends. We might be losing. But one thing I'm sure of, this is no time to stop.
These are the words of the Supreme Court's first Black justice, Thurgood Marshall, as he accepted the Jurist of the 20th Century Award from the National Bar Association. The year was 1988. Nearly a half century earlier, in 1940, Marshall had founded the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. The storied civil rights organization has only had seven presidents. And like its founder, its current leader, Sherrilyn Ifill, is a civil rights superhero. So it was a bit of a surprise when Ifill recently announced that she would be stepping down from the helm of LDF. After all, this is a moment that could be described as Marshall characterized 1988.
We're not gaining ground, my friends. We might be losing.
But again, to quote Marshall, this is no time to stop. Enter the LDS, soon to be 8th president.
My name is Janae Nelson. I'm the Associate Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund.
And as she gets ready to assume the role of leading the NAACP LDF, I asked Janae about the lessons she'll take from her predecessor, Sherrilyn Ifill, and the direction she hopes to build. Let me say congratulations. I know that you're going to be assuming the leadership of NAACP LDF as the 8th president coming up in the spring. And it's just wonderful news for all of us who have followed your career.
Thank you. I'm extremely excited and deeply honored.
Now, Sherrilyn Ifill is, those are some big shoes to fill and an extraordinary person to follow, who, of course, you know intimately from having worked with her. I'm wondering how you are imagining your own tenure, acknowledging that you can't know everything that will come in front of you. But what are some of the lessons you will take from the Ifill era? And what are some things you're imagining building on?
Yeah, Sherrilyn has been such an amazing leader, and it's been just an incredible journey to be with her for the past 8 years, helping to build LDF's profile and make it even stronger than when we encountered it, and certainly than when she encountered it a year before I got there. I'm excited because I don't need to transform this institution with such a storied legacy, but I have an amazing foundation on which to build. There's so much work ahead of us. There are so many challenges, and we have a formidable and growing team of advocates and staff ranging from researchers to organizers to policymakers to help us lift this heavy load. And it's going to be, I think, a very critical period for the Legal Defense Fund, because it is a critical period for our democracy. There are a lot of, challenges ahead for us, and that's what we're, honing our skills and tools to face.
You know, as you talk about the challenges facing our democracy in this moment, the question of education and of an understanding of our history is a core challenge we're currently facing.
Absolutely. We are in the midst of a serious battle that is a fight for the soul of this country. And it centers around our ability to hear, access, and absorb the truth. We are seeing so many laws proliferate across the country that aim to keep the truth of our history, the truth of our current conditions, away from the next generation of residents of this country. And it is something that is core to civil rights work, even if it's not obvious on the face of it. If we can't tell our truth, if we can't make a claim for justice, then we really have no ability to advocate for the advancement of our society, for equitable policies, for the change that we need to really live up to our constitutional ideals. So this battle for truth is at the center of the fight for our future.
Now, you talk about it as a battle for truth. You know, this has been framed in so many state legislatures as being about critical race theory, which I got to say, even in the most progressive districts, I can't imagine critical race theory, which was, of course, developed in law school education, being taught at a K-12 level. But what is it that is, you know, let's take out that language of critical race theory, which actually designates something very specific, and talk about what is embattled here. When you say truth, what do you mean?
What I mean is an honest conversation about the origins of this country, which we know were founded on the subjugation of not just Black people, but also Indigenous persons. And our country has gone through many iterations in which it has discriminated against various groups of people who have immigrated to this country in different ways. And a recognition of how we came to be the incredibly diverse nation that we are is something that we should embrace. We should celebrate the evolution of our country from one that was founded on enslavement to one that now has the potential to be the most ambitious democratic experiment I think this planet has ever witnessed, if we would let it be. And that is really what the concern is to try to stifle the reality of our history and how it manifests in inequities today. And that's because it really brings attention to the power structure that is in place right now. And it causes people to question why certain systems exist in a way that continue to perpetuate discrimination. And I think it's a direct backlash to the thirst for knowledge and the appetite that was unleashed last year when we saw protests across the country around police violence, where citizens from different backgrounds and ethnicities and generations came together and began to have a collective understanding about discrimination and inequality in our society. And that caused some people to become very nervous and very scared, and therefore to try to suppress the truth about our history and the path forward.
I'm wondering about the ways that the history of LDF included really indicating the rights of students, of young people, of individuals to access equal opportunities for education, whether at the earliest levels all the way up through college and graduate school. And it seems like that typically law, at least, right, sort of that jurisprudence has focused on the rights of people to access these ideas. And I'm wondering, you know, kind of flipping that, right, the rights to ensure that these ideas are in the public sphere in order to be accessed.
That's right. I mean, we've done work around access to education throughout our history. And obviously, the most well-known case in that area is Brown versus Board of Education, which ended state-sponsored segregation in public schools. And the right to access information, the right to information, is something that the Supreme Court has recognized. It's something that really is foundational to our Constitution and our core principles of freedom of expression and freedom of thought. And this is something that we've also celebrated in our affirmative action work when we talk about the need for diversity in higher education, for there to be an exchange of ideas, for there to be a diverse class of persons learning together who can inform one another's perspectives. We know that that produces the best and highest performing society, the best, most productive workplaces. We know that our diversity is our strength. And what we're seeing in this current iteration of whitewashing and of an effort to suppress the truth is a stifling of that diversity. We're seeing an effort to ignore what I think is one of the most profound stories of transformation and evolution that can propel us forward.
Typically, When we think also about the foundational rights of democracy, voting is there at the core, right? This is how we know kind of the health of our democracy. Are these two things connected in any way?
Absolutely. I think that what we're seeing is a effort on at least three fronts to silence the majority of persons in this country from exercising their voice and being heard and effecting change that reflects their conditions. We're seeing an assault on the right to vote. We're seeing an assault on the right to protest. And we are also experiencing what we've been talking about, and that is an assault on truth. And all three of those work to silence the emerging majority of people of color in this country. And that is a very, very dangerous circumstance. It is laying a foundation and paving a way for minoritarian rule, for very anti-democratic and authoritarian regimes to take root. And it is a significant barrier to our ability to realize the promise of this country, to realize the promise of this multiracial, multi-ethnic democracy.
Let's talk a little bit more about voting rights. Clearly, despite many calls for and legislative possibilities and options, the U.S. Congress was unable, at least at this point, to pass meaningful voting rights legislation. We now have new maps drawn in many states across there's new maps in nearly every state across the country, and some are undoubtedly going to come up for challenge, maybe particularly Texas and Georgia. I'm wondering how you're feeling about our current realities around voting, particularly going into the midterm elections.
Well, I'm deeply concerned. We are in dire need of federal legislation to restore the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which in my mind marks the first year that we became a real democracy. It was the first year in our history where all Americans were enabled to vote. And what we're seeing now is a Congress that has failed the American people, that has used the filibuster as a barrier to progress, to inclusion, to the expansion of the electorate that is absolutely necessary to make sure that we are reflecting the interests and the viewpoints of the majority of Americans who live in this country. What the Supreme Court said back in 1886 in a case called Yickwo versus Hopkins is as true today as it was then, and that is that the right to vote is preservative of all rights. If we don't have the right to vote, there's no way to protect and secure the other rights that we enjoy. And so this fight for the right to vote, this fight for federal legislation that will protect against partisan gerrymandering, that will protect against the manipulation of who gets to vote at the polls, that will ensure that basic principles like early voting are uniform. That fight is really critical to our ability to maintain this young democracy that we have. And we need two pieces of legislation to get us there, and that's the Voting Rights Advancement Act and the Freedom to Vote Act. And those are now currently being stalled in Congress.
Given the stall at the federal level around legislation, given the challenges of the Supreme Court, is there hope in the states? Which seems almost an odd thing to ask the NAACP LDF, but I'm wondering if there are strategies that are state-based, given sort of the realities of the filibuster and, again, of the conservative majority on the Supreme Court.
You know, it is a bit ironic that we're looking to states for some relief in this area, but it is an area of great possibility. There are states that have enacted their own voting rights acts, and it is something that we are advocating for in every state. We think it's critically important that there not only be federal legislation, but that there is also laws and protections at the state and local levels that expand voting access. The Constitution gives states very broad authority to determine the qualifications of the electorate. And there are ways that states can make their laws even more expansive than what we currently see at the federal level. So that is another avenue of advocacy. And while we're waiting for Congress to do its job and reflect the will of a majority of Americans, we can also be pushing states that are amenable to also enact legislation that will expand our democracy.
Janae Nelson is Associate Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund and soon President. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Melissa. It was my pleasure.
Today, all eyes are on the Supreme Court as the justices hear oral arguments in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. Now, this is about a 2018 Mississippi law that makes most abortions illegal after 15 weeks. The case is a direct challenge to the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade decision and is likely to be the most consequential abortion rights case in decades. As the justices hear arguments, advocates are gathering outside the court to express their support or opposition to abortion rights. The Takeaway spoke with one of those advocates, Dr. Dawn Godbolt, policy director at the National Birth Equity Collaborative. Her organization filed an amicus brief with the Supreme Court in support of the Jackson Women's Health Organization, which is the only remaining abortion provider in Mississippi.
So this morning, the Center for Reproductive Rights is presenting oral arguments before the Supreme Court in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. And so today we're here at the Abortion is Essential rally for our rights. Essentially, Dobbs versus Jackson is a case on the constitutionality of Mississippi's Gestation Age Act, which was passed in 2018, banning abortions after 15 weeks gestational age, except for the case of fetal abnormality and medical emergency. There are actually no exceptions for rape or incest, which usually are included in conservative, draconian, harsh bans that we see from states. There are an endless amount of problems with the ban. But the sticking point for Black women across the country, and why my organization, the National Birth Equity Collaborative, submitted an amicus brief, is because the case infringes upon one of the key tenets of reproductive justice. It is a human right to choose when and if we have children. And we also know that when bans like these are imposed, they have a disproportionate impact on women of color and Black women in Mississippi.
Okay. I want you to walk through some of the pieces of that with me. And I wanna push, because I know there are listeners for whom some pieces of that won't sort of initially, you know, all kind of cohere easily. So start with why abortion is part of a reproductive justice framework.
Sure. So I think that's a really great way for me to dive into really the nuances around access to abortion, healthcare access in this country, and again, what we call reproductive justice. The term reproductive justice was defined by Loretta Ross as the human right to maintain personal bodily autonomy, to have children, not have children, and to parent the children that we have in safe and sustainable communities. When she met with a group of Black women to discuss our reproductive oppression, and more significantly, the ways in which the larger white women-led women's groups left the issues of Black and brown women behind in favor of those largely raised by middle and high income white women, We recognized, these women recognized that a new movement was necessary to steer conversations towards the comprehensive needs of Black women across the reproductive life course. And so that includes your yearly checkups, your annual exams. It includes access to the full range of contraception and abortion care. And then the part about tying into sustainable communities is where we say, hey, let's look at the society that we live in, the society that produces maternal health disparities as a byproduct of our system, the way we access healthcare, including abortion care. To piggyback really quickly, I do want to highlight that Jackson Women's Health Organization is the only abortion providing clinic left in the state of Mississippi. And so when we look at a state like Mississippi, which comes up last on many, many public health indicators for well-being and health for women and infants, we ask ourselves, how can you say on one hand that you protect women's health when you have not enacted any policies that support women's health, support maternal health? In fact, you have enacted policies that restrict access to healthcare, including abortion.
You're talking specifically here about Mississippi, obviously, because that is where this case originates. But also expand for me. Will it matter to anyone other than people living in Mississippi, this decision by the court?
Oh, absolutely. I think first we should look at this as a series of attacks on Roe. And then we know the fallout that will come into play if Roe is overturned. There are 11 states that have trigger laws in place to ban all or nearly all abortions, including Arkansas, Idaho, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, North Dakota, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Tennessee, and Utah. These are states where we are holding on based on the Supreme Court's decision, but for all intents and purposes, Roe, if overturned, you will lead to the inability to access abortion in these states. And the nuances here is that it creates greater barrier. I know, you know, we hear people say, well, why not just drive across state lines? Why not just find a provider online? It's not always that easy for people when we are talking about low-income people. We are talking about people of color. We are talking about people who don't have the information they need.
As you're talking about the vulnerabilities and the communities most likely to be harmed as a result of fewer resources, right? Not being able to cross those state lines simply because, like, even the cost of gas, of staying a night in a hotel, of finding someone who can do that, right? Never mind that we continue to live in a pandemic. I'm wondering if advocates are maybe not even making the argument about just how far-reaching this could be. So just walk with me, Dr. Dawn, for a moment on this. So for a long time, the battleground has been about state laws around access. So your point about the one little pink, you know, clinic left in the state of Mississippi. But if Roe v. Wade is actually overturned by the Supreme Court, then are middle class, you know, white women, are, you know, married women living even in California, for example, where there isn't a trigger law, where we don't expect the next day for abortion to become illegal, are they made more vulnerable? Or is this really just a problem for the poorest and the brownest and the least enfranchised?
It's a problem for all of us, for every one of us. Our liberation is tied to those of our neighbors and our communities across this country, and even at a global level. The United States has some of the most draconian laws in place when it comes to abortion access, and these laws follow a trend and a pattern. And so the same way that we have restrictions and bans on abortion, the inverse of that is that we do not have policies that support families like paid leave or access to abortion or even equitable funding so that community health workers and perinatal birth workers can provide their services to all people. And so this idea that maybe it's just a women's issue, or maybe it's a Black woman's issue, or maybe it's a low income issue. This is not the case. We are talking about people, all people who have the capacity for birthing, having their constitutional right taken away from them. And this has a domino effect. I like to think of it as a web of oppression. And this web that we live in, others call it a matrix that we live in, it works together to oppress all of us in some way. Now, we know that for people of color, particularly Black people and Native American people, the margins are far wider, right? Like, we are on the edge here. There's not a lot of room for pushing. We know that we have higher rates of poverty, and with those higher rates of poverty come less access to health care, abortion care, and the other factors that people need to live healthy, full, and whole lives. So something that many of us across the advocacy space have been discussing is, you know, are abortion stories powerful enough? Are we sharing enough? Have we mobilized in the right way? And we have. There's a lot of work that we still need to do. We have started the mobilization, but there are so many allies who need to step forward and join us in this fight. I will particularly call on our male counterparts who often receive benefits from abortion procedures and not having the child they chose. They did not want to have a child. But we don't hear those stories. We don't hear men standing up and saying, when I was young and I was on spring break, I made a bad decision. We don't hear men saying, I did not want my wife to have another child because of X, Y, and Z. And I also want to underscore the point that the reason that somebody needs to access an abortion, none of those reasons matter. It has nothing to do with how old you are or where you live. Nothing makes you more or less worthy to access the healthcare you need. But we do know that some people have better access to resources. And so if you are from a middle or high income family, you do have access to a car. You have reliable access to money that would allow you to go across state lines. In the olden days, perhaps you knew, or your mother knew, or your grandmother knew somebody who worked in labor and delivery and could perform a procedure for you under the table and off record. We don't want to go back to those days where some people have access and others don't. The history of this country is one of inequitable access. Inequitable access, bias, systemic racism, all of those forces are at play here. And again, when we look at a state like Mississippi, you know, proclaiming to protect women's health, which first is paternalistic, we again say that women know what women need and what they want and should be in charge of making their own decision making. But Mississippi, again, ranks last among 50 states in public health measures and outcomes for women. One of the lowest performing states in terms of maternal health. If we saw the state take a meaningful turn towards supporting women's health, it would include open access to contraception, open access to abortion, and it would include those family supports like paid family leave that families need to thrive. But instead, we see this one issue carved out as being an indicator of the state's interest in women's health.
So on exactly that, just to wrap our last question, talk to me about Momnibus, about this legislative possibility that does exactly some of that health and life support work that you're calling for.
So Black Maternal Health Momnibus Act of 2021 is a labor of love. It was led by Representatives Underwood and Adams and Senator Cory Booker, a set of 12 bills designed to comprehensively address the ongoing Black maternal health crisis. And again, it upholds many of those tenets of reproductive justice. The Momnibus addresses 400 years of bad public policy, like slavery, Jim Crow, and our unjust justice system. Black women's input was critical in crafting these comprehensive legislative solutions. Congresswomen Underwood and Adams, they called on Black women, Black advocates, Black nurses, Black OBGYNs, Black doulas, Black midwives, Black people, and said, hey, what would a comprehensive set of maternal health legislation look like? And this is what we came up with. And we're actually really excited because right now in the House version of Build Back Better, all of the eligible items for reconciliation were included in the bill. And so this means we have historic, deep investments to grow and diversify the perinatal health workforce. This includes nurses and midwives, doulas, and other community birth workers. We have money to shore up health equity grant programs, to advance maternal health research at our HBCUs and minority-serving institutions. And then the last thing that I will flag from Build Back Better, actually, a bill championed by Congresswoman Kelly to extend postpartum Medicaid and CHIP coverage in every state to at least 1 year. These are full state plan benefits throughout pregnancy and the year after postpartum. And this is also including a $25 million Medicaid investment in maternal health homes to provide coordinated maternity care. We are really excited to see maternal health legislation moving. Again, we are the National Birth Equity Collaborative. And now we're just calling on our senators across the country to keep in those provisions that directly impact maternal health and the maternal health disparities that we are currently fighting and addressing.
Dr. Dawn Godbolt is the policy director at the National Birth Equity Collaborative. Dr. Godbolt, again, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
listening to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Reproductive rights are no laughing matter. But humor is one of the most important ways we respond to the stress and distress of political and social divisions. I mean, when you think about it, democracy is kind of hilarious. 330 million people living in nearly 4 million square miles, all trying to make decisions together. I mean, we can barely get all the people in my family to decide what we want for dinner. So while reproductive justice is a serious matter, it's also fertile ground for a little political humor, which is why The Takeaway called on one of our favorite funny ladies. Comedian Liz Winstead co-created The Daily Show in 1996, and she continued blending politics and humor ever since. Starting this week, she'll be co-hosting the Abortion Access Front's weekly YouTube show, Feminist Buzzkills Live. And on this critical week for abortion rights, I wanted to check in with Liz to get her perspective as both an activist and a satirist.
What's been happening over the past 10 years, and you and I have talked about this a lot, is that states have been eroding abortion access so profoundly that Roe v. Wade, as it stands right now, is just a shell of itself. And this Mississippi case that's going before the court today could be the last nail in the coffin of access to abortion as we know it, because we've been living under the guise that Roe v. Wade is still our constitutional right, that abortion access is available in all 50 states up until 24 weeks of gestational age. And it really hasn't been. And if we solidify that this 15-week ban that Mississippi has on the books, if the Supreme Court says, you know what, we're gonna uphold this, 50 years of precedent is down the drain. And also, there's 12 states that stand in the United States right now that have laws on the books that say, if the Supreme Court rules in favor of this Mississippi ban, they will ban abortion in all cases, which means over 40 million people with uteruses will be without access to abortion. It's really scary.
Okay, so I am a person without a uterus, and at, you know, at almost 48, no, actually, I think I am already 48. And at 48, I am not a person capable of pregnancy. So maybe I'll just ask this, why should it matter? Why should I care about abortion access? I'm not going to need one.
Right, and I think that's the question that way too many people have asked and answered for themselves, and it led them to check out. I think that this is so much more than abortion. This is literally saying, who gets to decide medical decisions for your body? It goes beyond abortion and goes into birth control, goes into medical procedures that somebody else might deem violates their constitutional rights for some reason. You know, when you look at the Texas case that we've been hearing about, where the Supreme Court allowed to continue this sort of bounty hunting on folks helping people access get abortions, that's deputizing, legal deputization of somebody's legal right to do something and saying that if you disagree with it, then you get to bring charges against someone. That doesn't just count for abortion, right? That's going to go into just that who you marry, who you love, how you feel, what we see, what's happening with, you know, the lies around critical race theory. All of these things, there's laws being created around, I don't like that, therefore I want to make it illegal. And we're on a slope of that feels really scary for me. So we all need to get together and understand that they lead with abortion because we as a society haven't really unpacked what abortion means for us in a healthy way, really having hard conversations around it, really trying to normalize it and put it back into its proper place of healthcare. And because those conversations don't happen, a lot of people get to frame it as dark, as regretful, as dangerous, when we have proven time and time again, science, folks who are living in post-abortive lives, that those things aren't the case. So unless we start talking about it and normalizing it, it's going to front face in ways that the rest of our rights in a domino effect could fall in line to be the next to be on the chopping block.
You're a humorist. You're a comedian. How can comedy, and humor help us to do better on that conversation about abortion that we haven't done very well. Mm-hmm. We tend to talk about it always as tragic, always as difficult, always as though to be humorous about it is an affront to the, like, you know, basic morality of a human being. But how can maybe lighten up a little bit, allow us more space to talk more honestly about it?
The one thing that I have been so profoundly sure of and watched change happen is when you can point out through humor the hypocrisy that A plus B has to equal C for it to be a fact. You know, there's been so much, we've been talking so much about conspiracy theories in our lives around everything else, that the conspiracy theories around access to abortion also exist. The players who have been dishonest brokers around abortion need to be held up and satirized. And that's what, how humor can really play a role in it. You know, when you look at the hypocrisy of the my body, my choice when it comes to a vaccine or a mask, and the same people are outside of a clinic saying, but you don't get to have your body, you don't get to have your choice. I mean, Melissa, I saw a woman outside of a clinic, she was holding a sign that said, I will not mask my unborn child. And I was like, well, you're wearing pants. So, you know, if you're wearing underwear, you might be double masking. Also, that's really not how it works. But, like, you know, it's like, what are you talking about? You know, when you hear them say things like, in Texas, after the Texas law passed, the same people who were co-sponsors of that bill sponsored a bill that said that we should be putting pregnant people in the HOV lanes on highways because it's two people and they should be in the carpool lane. And you're like, I'm sorry, does that mean that we get to start child support, you know, right after sex, like light up a cigarette, have sex, light up a cigarette, start the child support? Like, what kind of laws are you talking about? When you can take their ridiculous logic to the ridiculous conclusions, you can find humor in that. And that humor can often lay out the hypocrisy of what's happening and just lay out the real world, like, consequences of what that is. And it's terrifying, but it also can be funny, because the truth be told, you know, when you can't, there is no world where there is unicorns and abstinence, you know, there just isn't. But I, you know, and so that's the kind of thing where I just feel like pointing out the truth of the world we live in and also acknowledging it, because people have been having sex since they discovered it was fun. And when it's free and fun and you're having an economic hardship of a time, and then also you're not being educated on birth control and sex ed and anything else, you are creating a society that you then in turn oppress by all the options to help people learn about things. And I just don't understand how you can say, I would like to reduce abortion. And the way I want to do that is to ignore that sex even exists and never teach about safe ways to prevent pregnancy. That doesn't track.
Okay. You are killing my buzz in this moment. We started out with the funny, and then my buzz was killed by, like, the realities of our political world. So tell me about your new feminist talk show, Feminist Buzzkills.
Being an activist in this space for a long time, one of the things that has laid bare for me is that the conversation around legislation, around abortion as a procedure, the lives of people that provide it, the activists who help fund it, and the people who have abortions, those stories aren't told. And unless we consistently tell the stories of how profound these laws are and where they're happening, unless we tell the stories of people who provide them, and unless then we have the activists who are on who are smart and funny and interesting, we're never going to have educated conversations around abortion. We're not going to have people who have critical historical knowledge of this. And we wanted to just create a space where three people who are activists and I'm a comedian, and one person is a marketing guru, and one person works at a practical support fund, which helps people access childcare and travel and housing when they have to travel for abortion. For us to have those conversations and invite scholars and invite people who are providing the care and the researchers who are bringing the facts, we'll be able to educate folks to have smart conversations and give them information on how they can fight back before our hair is all on fire and we're at the Supreme Court. And then also to hear from musicians and activists and artists who are doing really interesting work in their own right, in their performances, in their music, in their comedy, that talks about this issue. So a weekly talk show that talks about these issues is much needed. And also to get our folks on board who have sort of ignored it for a long time. You know, I come from The Daily Show, Air America Radio, places that are steeped in talking about politics through satire. And abortion was almost never on the table. And often in organizations that were run by men, they were like, oh, it's a wedge issue. Are men going to want to hear about it? I'm like, you want to know what? Men not only should hear about it, they should be participating with us in this fight, because the patriarchy doesn't take a holiday, A. And B, you talk to any straight man and say, how is your life better because of birth control and abortion? And if people had to unpack that to say, did your partner mostly pay for the birth control? Maybe you split the cost of an abortion that the two of you decided to have. But did you get to go on and have a successful career because the both of you decided that that wasn't the time you wanted kids? And did your partner who had the abortion have the same success as you? You know, asking men to ask those questions, I think, is really important to get them invested into the fight and into this conversation. Because if we say we care about humanity and we care about the self-determination of every person, and let's be honest, these abortion bans, they affect mostly folks of color, low-income folks, the most marginalized. If you care about helping everybody get on that path of self-determination, you have to care about this issue, regardless of whether or not you don't have a uterus. Your uterus is like mine. I use it for storage. I use it on... You know, it's like you're invested because you care about a better world for everybody.
As you're talking about these comedy shows committed to thinking about politics, but not wanting to do the abortion wedge issue, Cecily Strong's recent sketch about abortion definitely struck a nerve.
I had an abortion the day before my 23rd birthday.
Okay. It seems like you do want to talk about your abortion.
Well, actually, I really don't. But people keep bringing it up, so I got to keep talking about freaking abortion. But it's a rough subject, so we're going to do fun clown stuff to make it more palatable. Whee!
Any sort of reactions to it? Thoughts about how that plays into this broader set of cultural mores that you're trying to shift and push for us?
You know, I think that I was so impressed by it because, you know, I'm somebody who has always, you know, combined politics and talking about my own abortion through humor. And I'm doing this massive, you know, one woman show at the end of the year in Minneapolis, where I incorporate a lot of that into this because it's really important to make sure that this is happening. But when I watched Cecily do that, she broke the stigma down and said, I know I'm going to get blowback, but we need to start busting down barriers. And so to be a clown, and to be clowning and using clown language and removing herself and inserting a clown, I thought it was meta. And it was also something that you wouldn't normally see the abortion clown. And I think that was the point. What are clowns associated with? And to associate them then with abortion, I thought was really brave. And I thought that she knew that she was gonna get just an incredible amount of hatred lobbed at her. And the fact that she knew that going in and did it anyway, because somebody needs to start taking the barriers down. And I think that those of us in the fight right now understand that we're gonna get the most hatred, but we gotta clear a path. And I'm willing to just be the person that clears the path for other folks right now, because if we don't start the hard conversations, we're never going to get equality for people. We're just not.
Liz Winstead is the co-creator of The Daily Show and co-host of Abortion Access Front's weekly YouTube show, Feminist Buzzkills Live. Thank you for joining us, Liz.
Thank you, Melissa.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and today is World AIDS Day. 35 million people have died from HIV or AIDS-related illnesses over the past four decades, a number that continues to climb. At the same time, during the past 2 years, COVID has claimed 5 million lives, and those numbers also continue to climb. So even though we don't always recognize and discuss it, we are living at a time of dual pandemics, and both have disproportionate effects on the most vulnerable. Here to speak with us about World AIDS Day and the importance of addressing global inequities is Dr. Stephen Thrasher, professor at Northwestern University, author of the upcoming book, The Viral Underclass, The Human Toll When Inequality and Disease Collide. Stephen, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much, Melissa. It's always great to talk to you.
In this moment, as we are talking about the Omicron variant and travel bans out of Africa, talk to us about how the transmission and treatment of HIV/AIDS around the globe mirrors some of these COVID-19 transmission pathways and neglect.
Well, we see a lot of the same stigmas and fears, particularly around borders in both pandemics, and they run along colonial routes. If you want to see the inequities of healthcare and how disease is distributed, how it's treated, you can really follow these routes. HIV was first noticed in the United States in 1981, but then the United States also was the first country to get and widely distribute medication for it in 1996, and that made its rate of death go down a great deal. But there was a long lag, 7-8 years, until those drugs became available in the global south, in countries like South Africa, and so their death tolls continued to spiral. And we're seeing a lot of the same things now with vaccine inequity that countries in the West, people are getting 2, 3, 4, sometimes 5 shots to make sure that they're boosted correctly, while even healthcare workers in the global south have not gotten such medication. And then in the global north, we're denying those countries the ability to travel while also making variants and transmission more likely in the global south by denying sharing the medications that have been developed.
I'm wondering if you see this as having failed to learn the lessons of global inequality in the context of HIV/AIDS. We make ourselves more vulnerable, right? In fact, the whole globe more vulnerable in the context of COVID-19 because it's obviously such a far more transmissible disease.
Very much so. There's no reason why anyone should die of AIDS. The virus HIV is actually pretty inefficient and relatively slow moving from the time someone becomes infected. It can be 10 or 15 years until they become very sick and pass away. And so we have a really big window of time to give them the support and care that they need. And we have the medication, we have the technology to do it. We have the ability to distribute it en masse to such a degree that it would help transmission rates fall to maybe imperceptible levels. But to protect the profits of pharmaceutical companies, that doesn't really happen. And that's the same thing happening with COVID-19 medications and with vaccinations. And we also haven't been taking, and particularly in the United States, good advantage of the time that we've been given available. So even though HIV was first noticed in the US, COVID-19 was noticed in China and moving quite rapidly through Italy months before it was really working its way through the United States. And the United States has not taken advantage of that time. We've also had a head start with vaccines. We had them on a large scale before most other countries, and we haven't taken advantage of that to such a degree that the number of people who've died of COVID-19 has surpassed the number of people who've died of HIV/AIDS in the United States in less than 2 years. And I'm talking about numbers over 40 years of AIDS deaths in the US. That number has been surpassed in less than 2 years with COVID-19 inside the United States.
I'm wondering just if you can reflect on, like, what do you think is going on there? Like, I so distinctly remember watching COVID-19 sort of approach the shore, right? Like kind of the initial conversations as though it was, you know, simply SARS, you know, that would largely impact China, maybe other parts of Asia, but wouldn't have an enormous impact here. Then watching it sort of come to Europe, and even as we were covering it in US media in Europe, not quite catching that anything, you know, that moved at this kind of rate was clearly going to jump the Atlantic. And I guess, I mean, it did feel like a almost as if the entire country had our head in the sand. And I'm wondering if you're thinking that is connected in some ways to our understandings or our beliefs, our stereotypes about who gets infected with disease and who is protected from it.
It certainly does. We didn't have to have the level of death and destruction that we've had in the United States, but we've built a society that was prepared for it. We have a society full of kindling, and when a match falls on it, something like this will move very quickly. Even though these viruses are quite different, they affect similar populations of people, people who don't have good housing, good ventilation, people who are incarcerated, who live on the margins and don't have access to the needed tools of life for safe living. And so when a much more transmissible virus arrives, that's exactly what's happened. I've been thinking a lot about how we have surpassed the number of deaths in the United States with COVID-19 domestically of Americans who've died of this compared to AIDS. But the global rate is much lower. About 5 million people have died of COVID-19 compared to 35 to 40 million people who died of HIV/AIDS. And I think that speaks to the ways that some societies were better at collectively agreeing to do what they needed to protect each other in the COVID-19 crisis. I think it also speaks to the ways that marginalized people who are affected by HIV/AIDS were quite prepared to do what they needed to protect one another in the United States. But the larger society has fought it in lots of ways. And when I look back on the history of HIV and AIDS, it's a really remarkable and beautiful thing when you study and see how gay men taught each other to start using condoms when they weren't needed for procreation in the 1980s. When you look at people who have used injection drugs or are dealing with addiction, how they have taken to using sterile syringes and teaching one another to do so. And you can really see these networks of care that have developed amongst marginalized communities. The broader society sometimes would like to accuse in those early days of AIDS gay people of quote unquote bug chasing, saying they were trying to get the virus. But that never happened at the level of gay leaders or gay people doing public health. But with COVID-19, we have very wantonly seen conservative politicians and conservative media figures encouraging people to bug chase, encouraging them to get COVID-19 and completely disregarding what we need, what we know needs to be done. So I've been thinking a lot about how that is a dynamic and why we're having such a worse experience of COVID-19 in the U.S. compared to the rest of the world.
Even as you're reflecting on these ways that vulnerable communities and nations understood how to support, had built certain kinds of social infrastructures, even over and against these inequalities, I wonder if you can also reflect for us for a moment on this World AIDS Day about the importance of remembrance and of mourning.
Yeah, so it's really important to remember the people who have lived with HIV and who've died of AIDS. And I think of specific people in my life, particularly my friend Henry, who had HIV for several decades and had a very difficult life and had to fight legally discrimination that he faced. And he was successful and helped make life better for other people. I do think that as people think about COVID-19, I also think of an individual who died, and the numbers can seem overwhelming. Hearing that 800,000 people have surpassed dying of COVID-19 compared to 700,000 of HIV/AIDS can make it hard to picture the individuals in the way that they need to be respected. But I do think it's significant that the 700,000 people died of AIDS did so over four decades, and we're dealing with a larger volume of death in less than 2 years. And so I think that we need to take World AIDS Day as a moment to think about the importance of mourning, of remembering, to look at the ways that people who cared for those who lived with HIV and who cared for those who died of AIDS did so in a way that made space to love those people and to remember them after they're gone. And I don't feel like we just have had in any way the collective or individual ability to mourn the hundreds of thousands of people who've died in the United States and the millions of people who've died globally in this pandemic in less than 2 years. And we really need to prioritize grief and mourning and remembrance in community.
Yeah, I keep wondering if just as we are in our very sort of American way, pushing towards, oh, tomorrow and better and normal and the horizon, just how much trauma we are leaving unresolved.
There's a huge amount of trauma. And I have often been perplexed with the anti-vaccination movement when I think of in the early 90s, how everyone who was losing people to AIDS, if a medicine had come along to prevent that, would have been dancing in the street. And I also think a lot about how, as people were losing and continue to lose loved ones to AIDS, I never hear them saying they want to get back to normal. There is no normal to go back to when you're losing one person you love or hundreds of thousands or millions of people to a virus. You can't go back to normal. You are dealing with a loss that cannot be fulfilled. And you often, I've noticed with activists, try to imagine a better world and a different world that led to the death of your loved one. And so the impetus to go back to normal is so strong in the United States that it disregards why we are having so many people die of this new virus. And those conditions, regardless of any virus, need to be changed to better the lives of the people who are likely to be infected by pandemics.
Dr. Stephen Thrasher, professor at Northwestern University and author of the upcoming book, The Viral Underclass, The Human Toll When Inequality and Disease Collide. As always, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
That's all we have for y'all today. I can barely believe it's December. And even though it's been quite a year, we hope everyone's finding a bit of respite in this season of lights. Happy Hanukkah to all who are celebrating. And for the Christmas revelers, just 24 shopping days to go. Call us with your show ideas and suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or as always, send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. We'll see you back here tomorrow.